Kelsey Hornbacher, acting as the interviewer for Jane Pyatt for the Lansing Unit of the Women's Overseas Service League on April 21st, 1983. Jane, what did you do overseas and why did you go into the service?
Well, as it happened, I was, my father had no sons to go to the service, and when war broke out, and I was in at the University of Michigan getting my master's degree, the idea was being established that there was a possibility we were going to have a women's service. And so I followed it very carefully, and as soon as the applications were had been printed and were being distributed, I had a friend of mine picked up a couple of them, and she and I both applied. We were very good friends in Lansing, and as it happened, both of us were selected out of the first four women selected from Michigan. In all, there were 440 of us who had been selected out of the 150,000 women who applied. And we reported to Des Moines, Iowa on July 21st, 1942. The experience of the training was a lot of fun. To begin with, most of the men who were working with us were cavalry men, and they were not the least bit happy about being stationed in Des Moines working with a bunch of women. They thought that the story they'd have to tell their grandchildren was going to be pretty sad when instead of being out fighting the battle, they were teaching women to march. However, before we finished our training, we had sold the men on the idea that women could do the work.
Weren't there any horses there?
Yeah, there were a few horses, literally, around there. And all of our officers dressed in the typical uniform, you know, with the breeches and the boots, and also carried their little sticks and wore the cavalry hats. So it was a lot of fun. I mean, most of the officers were really fine people. And they became very fond of the women and very proud of us. And there was a lot of competition between the different platoons. And the day we graduated, there were not just a few tears among the men as we marched down for our graduation ceremony. Actually, it was pretty exciting. Mrs. Hobby, who was at that time the only colonel, the only woman colonel, came to visit us twice during our time. And I think most of us would have followed her right out into battle at that point because she was a very impressive person. After I was commissioned, I received the assignment of being the first woman mess officer. And I was given a 300 man mess that I was to be the chief officer for. Unfortunately, I had to take it over from a man who had been our foods instructor during our classes, who knew literally nothing about foods. And he was more than happy to see me embrace his little mess that he had not done very well with. But we had very good luck. I had all women working. I had a woman baker, a woman butcher, a woman mess sergeant, and all women employees in the in my mess. And they loved it. From the gals working on the dishes right on down to my baker and butcher, who really took a lot of pride. And before very long, we were not feeding 300 people. We were feeding almost 800. Everybody that could was eating in our mess. We changed from the typical cafeteria style to family style. I found out that we had plenty of dishes in the storage room, and we turned in all the trays and got requisitioned sheets from the hospital to be used as tablecloths. The girls took some of our empty pickle jars and decorated them and went out in the fields and got wildflowers. And the morning that we opened the mess, we had a beautiful looking dining room. And the general and everybody else everybody else that possibly could find a way to our mess ate with us. And the food was excellent. And I had that mess for about 5 months, and then they transferred me to the officers' club, which I only took for 3 months because I was very unhappy there. There was a lot of racist feelings. We had some really fine Negro women in the first class of women officers, and they were not being allowed to use our officers' club. And so in protest, I asked to be transferred, and then I was sent to Des Moines.
Back in those days, did they use the term Negro instead of black?
Yes, they did. Negro was the word. Black came in sometime later. I'm not sure. I think black even came in the 50s. and this was in the middle and early 40s. So, Charity Adams was one of the first women officers to become a major, and she was a beautiful woman. I traveled with her for a period of 2 weeks at the direction of the general. We went with it for a 200 radius of Fort Des Moines to find out what the feeling was in the small towns. And we found out that when Charity was alone, she was not allowed to stay in a hotel. And if we went in together, we were not allowed to stay. But if I went in alone, I could get a room without any problem. And it was very upsetting to them. Then when I went back to get my luggage, and I came back with Charity with me, and they couldn't do anything about it. But we told them that this was going to be reported to the Army, because there was not supposed to be any discrimination at that point. And Charity was a really very fine woman. So that was our very beginning.
And this was in Iowa?
Iowa. Fort Des Moines, Iowa. Uh-huh. And we still had men on the post at that time, but by the time we'd been there about 6 months, it was all turned over to the women. We had all women except the general. The base colonel and the general were men on the base. There were, at that point, we only had one woman colonel, and that was Colonel Hobby, Ovita Culp Hobby, who was a very interesting person. And she came to visit us, as did Mrs. Roosevelt, in February of 1943. We had a very impressive parade, both on the base, on the post, and downtown in Fort Des Moines. And the temperature was 9 degrees below zero, and Mrs. Roosevelt and Colonel Hobby stood out and watched the review of the troops outdoors in the wind. And it was so cold that the commanding officers of the various platoons, while we were waiting for the officials to arrive, would have to have their girls marching and jumping to keep us from freezing our toes. I was walking with the officers, marching with the officers, and so we didn't get the opportunity to get warmed up the way the enlisted women did. And then I had to leave the ranks and go to the hotel where she was going to be coming to eat, because I was responsible for it.
What month was this again?
In February of 1943.
And was there a great deal of snow in Iowa then?
Yes, we had a lot of snow, but mostly at that particular time, right on top of the snow, we had extremely cold weather for about 10 days. And some of the women, the enlisted women, did not have proper uniforms, and they had to send to a nearby Army base and have them send over men's clothing. And we had some of the small women were wearing overcoats that were so large that as they walked along, they literally took about two steps before you saw the coat move. You couldn't see their hands. Their hands were way up in the sleeves. And they had knitted caps that came clear down over their ears. They were a pretty sorry-looking bunch of people, believe me, but it was all, you know, a joke. And before very long, they did get their correct uniforms. They had a much bigger supply of women than they actually had originally anticipated. The volunteerism among women was a fantastic thing. And all you had to do to say to a woman if she complained was, you know, you volunteered to do this job. Nobody made you come. And we didn't have too much trouble with women getting into problems of that kind.
Jane, what was the pay during those days? Do you remember at all?
I well remember. $50 a month. And then from that you were given a food allotment to eat on the base. If you ate off the base, and you paid out of your own money. And our uniforms were supposed to be furnished, but for most of us, they didn't fit very well, and so we sent home for money and had our uniforms tailored as soon as we possibly could. But the uniforms were at that time the typical army olive green, I suppose you'd call it. It was really kind of a sickish brown. And we wore the same color skirt as jacket, and then tan shirts with the light tan necktie. And we had the regular high collar neck shirts with the four in hand ties. And we had what I always called was the Foreign Legion type cap, the round cap that stood up about 3 inches on our heads. And then our summer uniform, of course, was a khaki uniform. And then with our dress uniform, we did have what was called a pink skirt. It was really a pinkish gray.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned $50 a month. Compared to the years 1943 when I was teaching, I was making $140 a month. In the factory that same year, I worked in the summer, and I made $280 a month in the precision department at General Motors in Flint. I thought it would be nice to make this comparison.
Well, it really was something, and because ours, the $50 a month wasn't really as bad as it sounds, because we did get an extra allotment for food as officers, and the enlisted personnel got their food free on the, you know, they had nothing to pay. It was, I don't think any of us really gave it much thought, because we had nothing to spend our money on, and in the first 5 weeks when we were being trained, we were so tired that we didn't want to go anywhere until about Friday after Saturday afternoon. We had to work all through Saturday morning.
You mentioned free time. About how much free time did you have?
Well, I don't think that we really had, as what you'd call free time, more than about through our lunch period, which was exactly an hour, and then we had classes until about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And then the instructors were free to make us do extra drill or extra classwork if they felt that we needed it. So that there were many times when we would report in 15 minutes before we had to march to dinner at night. And then as soon as we finished dinner, we had extra classes or had to go and drill again. So I don't think, we didn't do anything like going to movies or anything like that. We had no time.
I'm sort of curious, did the gals drink beer or wine or the men?
Yes, we did. And I'm sorry to say, I think that there were many women who literally became alcoholics as a result of their service, because during our training time, weekends primarily were the only times that we really had any opportunity to drink. At night, we honestly and truthfully were too tired to do anything except shower and go to bed and study. We all had to study awfully hard, because transferring from a civilian's life to a military life involved a whole new way of living, including a jargon, a language that was totally different too. And we had a lot to learn in the 5 weeks. Normally that class it was 6 weeks, but because of the fact that our uniforms were not ready and all of the staff wasn't on hand, we ended up with 5 weeks. So that was hard. But after we became officers and had free time at night and free time on weekends, we did drink. And at first we weren't allowed at the officers' club. And then they opened up the officers' club. That was when I said they wouldn't let the Negro women come. But we drank in our rooms, and we did. We drank an awful lot. As I look back on it now, I sometimes don't see how we managed, because we would go into Des Moines on Saturday at noon and take rooms in the hotels, and most of us just went to bed and slept for about 5 hours and then got up and did the town. But we really couldn't do much in the town as such, because we had to wear uniforms, and you're not allowed to drink in uniform. So that cut that sort of thing until later when people began disobeying. But in the beginning, bunch of us, we were pretty law-abiding. I mean, we were pretty terrified of breaking rules. And any drinking we did in our hotel rooms or private clubs.
What about your sleeping conditions? Were you in bunks?
No, well, we had regular, typical Army beds in dormitories in our training period. You were dormitoried by platoons, and there were in each company there were 4 platoons, and in the first class there were 4 companies, so there were 16 platoons, and we had about 30 women, I think, in each platoon, and those were big dormitory rooms, and I had a bed next to a gal who was 52 years old. And she was a political appointee. Her name, she was came from a very wealthy family in New York City, and had never had to do anything, the kind of type of thing that we had to do, scrubbing floors and walls and woodwork and making your own bed and all of that sort of thing. And she was a J.P. Morgan granddaughter. And but she was a good sport. And to top it all, she had a very bad back and was partially deaf. But she need not have gone through this training. She could have gotten a commission appointment direct, but she chose to go through with us, and it was mighty hard. And so she marched, she was tall, and she marched right near me. And so she used to watch me. But if she took her eye off of me and we were given a command and she didn't hear it, she was liable to find herself marching down the field by herself. But she was a good sport. And one day I came in to the quarters, and Helen had been excused from a drill because of her back. And it was a hot night, and I came in and unfastened my shirt, the top of my shirt, and had my hat on the back of my head, and discovered somebody sitting on my bunk. And believe me, that's a crime punishable almost by death, because at all times our beds are supposed to be so tight and taut that you could bounce a quarter off from them. And I marched over to this gal and was had all intent to really say something, and I happened to notice that there were eagles on her shoulders. We only had one officer with eagles on her shoulders, and that was Evita Kalpavi. And it turned out that she was a very good friend of Helen's, and so Helen introduced me to her, and Colonel Hobby jumped up and said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, I'm sitting on your bed, aren't I? And I know that's against the rules." And I said, "Oh, ma'am, do sit on my bed. I'd be proud to have you do it." And I had several other contacts with Mrs. Hobby after that. I served her when she was came back to Fort Des Moines one time with a bad cold. And two of us went over and spent the evening with her and rubbed her back and tried to get her to feel better, because she was supposed to go out the next day. But she was feeling so badly that her aide asked us if we would stay with her while she went down to the railroad station to make a change in reservations. And we had an opportunity to really give her some insights on what was going on. This was when we told her that the women never should have to lift those 100-gallon GI cans, that we were having problems in this kind of thing. And she listened to us and wrote it all down. And so from then on, whenever she came, wherever I was, if she found out I was stationed there, she'd look me up. And it was a nice contact.
Back in the factory, back in those days, we weren't to lift over 25 pounds.
And you know, this is still a problem. The men are saying if the women want to do everything that the men do, then they should have to lift all these things. And they're having really quite a bit of controversy about this, although I now hear that they've decided that it's better not for the women not to do all of the training with the men. They've gone back to separating the women because of the fact that their bodies are just not built in the same way. There are some women who literally can compete job for job with a man. But we made up in quantity by doing a better quality of our job, we felt. And every woman was perfectly willing to lift two 50-gallon cans as opposed to one 100-gallon can.
How long did you stay in Des Moines?
I was transferred from, wait a minute, I stayed in Des Moines after I got to be an officer. I was commissioned at the end of August, and the next March I was sent to Washington to be one of the first four women in the Inspector General School.
This is in 1944?
1943, March of 43. It was a month's course, and there were four women and 175 men. Most of the men were colonels and lieutenant colonels, and we were lieutenants and captains. And we came out the top of the class, the four of us. So, but the part of it was because we spent our time studying, and most of the men didn't. They spent their nights carousing and having big times, and then they flunked their exams. But we worked like the Dickens, and we got good grades. Then I came back, and I was an inspector on our post until October. And in October of 43, I was transferred to the Army Air Corps and sent to the First Air Force headquarters in Tampa. And I was sent down as an inspector general, but when I got there, I heard about the air inspector's office and listened to the man in charge of the air inspector office, and I was so fascinated with that job that I went to the office and asked to see him. And his executive officer kept putting me off and telling me that he was busy and he couldn't see me and so on. So I found out what day the executive officer had off. And then I went in and presented myself personally to Colonel Ennis. And he gave me an interview and handed me a portfolio and said, I'll have a car outside and you'll be sent out to make your first inspection and you'll meet the team out there. So I had an opportunity then to travel with a team of officers by plane when we were inspecting units all over the eastern coast. And I can't remember just how far out west we went, but we had some kind of hairy experiences, and I had that job from October of 1943 until July of 1944, when I was transferred to Florence Army Air Force Base with Colonel Ennis. He was sent there to take over. We had made an inspection and found a very terrible situation going on, and when we reported it back, my colonel was promptly sent there to head the program there. And he, the officer that we were replacing was discharged with a dishonorable discharge. And he and I went out, and he wanted me to take over a squadron of women, but he wasn't able to get them, and I was glad that he wasn't, because I had had, the only training I'd had in giving orders for marching was in my basic training and in my officer's school. So I was very grateful that he was never able to get the women, and instead he made me then officer's club officer, and I had a chance to take a very bad situation and turn it into a really fine club. And I was there until October of 1944.
What were your activities in the officers' club that made it a very fine club?
Well, to begin with, the man that had been in charge had been in cahoots with the base colonel and with the officers' club sergeant and the supply officer and his sergeant, and they had been stealing and been serving very poor food. The officers' club was a mess. It was filthy, dirty, and so were the officers' quarters. And so it didn't take very much to get in and really clean it all out. I had a little, I was given the opportunity to pick my own mess sergeant, officers' club sergeant, and I found out that one of the units had a man who was really fantastic, and I went down to the squadron and watched him work and finally propositioned him to come and be my mess sergeant. And he told me no, he couldn't come because he was due to have a leave and he hadn't had one for 3 years. So I went back and talked to my colonel, and he said, well, make him any offer you can. So I went back and said, well, if you'll come and work a week to get us started, then I will see to it that you have a 3 week leave, and also that you get a promotion. And he came to me, but he came back at the end of 10 days. He was so excited in the change we were making in the officers club.
In what sort of a building was this club housed?
It was a wooden, it was a frame building. At the officers club was really quite nicely laid out. There was a great large living room, huge living room. When we took it over, the rug had been rolled out up, and it was out on the front porch, and it was rotted. And all of the lamps had no shades and one bulb in it. All of the upholstery had burned spots and broken springs. It was really a depressing place. And the colonel gave me permission and almost carte blanche money to go ahead and get something done about it. And we went, his wife and I went to Charlotte, North Carolina, to a large store there, and were able to get a hold of a Persian rug that was 60 feet by 40. And we got it for $700, with the agreement that at the end of the time, if the base were closed, it could be returned for the same amount of money. And when we brought it back, everybody said, well, it'll never last because the men will ruin it. And I said, they won't ruin something that's nice. And they never did. I never had anybody grinding a cigarette into the floor or spilling stuff and this sort of thing. The club was kept beautifully. And we put in all new lamps and new chairs and davenports and jukebox and the whole works.
What was the building used for before you used it as an officer's club?
It was built as an officer's club. The Air Force Base had been there as a training base before the war started. And we had something like 45 units for officers' quarters. And they were little wooden motel rooms. And they were, when we got them, they had a bed and a chair in it and a single light bulb in the center of the room. And I put in rugs, not carpets, but rugs, and a comfortable chair and a desk. And we got all new beds and mattresses and put in drapes and lamps. And the men didn't mind paying their money then. Before, I wouldn't have blamed them if they'd all stood up and said, we're not going to pay to live in this hog pen. But there was no place else to live in Florence at that time. They had one hotel. And it was almost impossible to find a room, you know. So they had to live on the base. I was able to live off the base because they had no quarters for women at all. And so I lived, one of the officers asked me, he and his wife asked me to live with them. And I lived with them until I was able to locate a room, which turned out to be about 8 months that I stayed with them. And then I found a room where I had a room and bath. in the parents of one of the officers on the Cub. But it was a fun experience, and it was a successful one. And then I went from there. I was ordered to Fort Dix as a counselor. The war was over.
Oh. Where is Fort Dix?
In New Jersey. And the men were all coming back from service, and I was counseling them as to what their benefits were and how they could go about getting housing if they were single people, and where they could go to apply for jobs, this sort of thing. I tried not to tell them about the benefits that they could have financially if they didn't get a job, because we had discovered that most of them just plain didn't try to get a job. They just took the benefits. But I was there from October until the third week of December, and I had enough points then to get out. And since my mother had died, I decided to go home and be with my dad and go out of service. But we were told that we were not being allowed to actually go off from service. We were called, we were considered to be in United States Army still, and could be called back at any time. And then in 1948, they decided to go on and have a women's army a permanent base idea. And I had an opportunity to go into the as regular or to go in as reserve. And since I had built another nursery school by that time, I decided that I'd better take a reserve commission and go into the Air Force, because I had been serving with the Air Corps. So I took a reserve commission in the Air Force, and in 1952, at the end of 1951, I was recalled, time of Korea, and was recalled to recruit women from university women, and it was supposed to have been just a temporary one-month assignment, but at the end of the 1 month, I received orders for the next year. And then before that year was up, it was extended to 2 years, and then that was when I was sent to England. And in England, I was sent to a big Air Force base. In fact, it's the largest supply depot in the world. And there we did do all the supply, strangely enough, for Korea, and training all of the officers. And much of my job was secret, and so that I had to have a special kind of a clearance. And first I was an air inspector at Burtonwood Air Force Base, which was this big depot. And then I was sent down to Bryce Norton, which was a special training base down about 50 miles north of London. And there I acted as administrative officer, which was the equivalent to the old adjutant. And I had a young officer, commanding officer, who was a very interesting person. And I enjoyed working with him. He just turned over the job to me until he found out that I was having to pass out prophylaxis. And then he was very concerned about that I would have to do such a terrible job. And I told him that it didn't bother me at all. I was very glad to do it, that I lectured the men when I passed them out. And I had a sergeant who actually dispensed them. But I worked with the English people who were working on the base. I heard their problems and their complaints. And I had to talk to the mothers of women who were pregnant and help to straighten out the affairs of the men. And then I was a go-between between the squadron officers and the colonel. And if they came to see him and I felt that the colonel was having a bad day, I would tell him to come back in the afternoon or the next day or something, so that we would to make as little friction as possible. And he was a very interesting person. He was known in the beginning as being the strictest man, I guess, in England. And he even was doing such things as having church call, which had long gone out. And the men just hated that. But he had given that up when I got down there. And he had a wife and 5 children that were delightful people. And I think he learned a lot. I mean, he really was a good officer. And he took me, I went on several trips with him to the continent. And the last trip we came back, he wanted to sleep, so he turned the plane over to me. And I had been, something I'd eaten apparently had disagreed with me, and when they had called me to tell me to go out and get the plane ready, to go get it stacked with sandwiches and coffee, I was half sick. So went halfway over the channel, when he said, "Here, you take the wheel," I was petrified. And he slept, and he stayed asleep until we got way past the White Cliffs of Dover. And I knew that we should be making a turn, and I didn't know anything more about handling the plane. I couldn't get him to wake up finally. He just said, oh, you can do it. But I finally got impressed him with the idea. We were already past our point of turn. And I was there from February of 1953 until July of 1954. And I came back to the United States and stayed in the reserve and was assigned to Selfridge Air Force Base, where I went on, I first went down once a week, and then it was, it got to be too much with my teaching in Lansing, and I asked to be put on another type of service where I went only once a month. And then in 1967, I decided the rat race of getting up and leaving Lansing at 4 o'clock in the morning and in the wintertime having to go down all the way down and all the way back in pitch dark, and then in the summertime having to follow cars pulling boats and all this sort of thing at the crack of dawn. It was just getting to be too much of a hassle. And by that time I had some 29 years time, so I took a retirement and became a Air Force Reserve retired.
Then may I ask what financial benefits you have from this?
I got a pretty good retirement. At the time, I thought, you know, if I got $50 or $60, it would be enough to make a payment on something. But much to my amazement, that pay now is up over $500 a month. And I could have the benefit of using military hospitals if I was anywhere near enough to do it. But the way my military insurance is set up, I can use any hospital that's approved. Hospitals that are taking Medicare benefits, and my MediPlus, which is what the military insurance is called, is a great help. And I could also maybe using commissaries and post exchanges, but we don't have any anywhere near Lansing. Frequently, if I'm traveling and going near a military base, I will go on the post and use an officer's club or something like that, particularly if it's a famous one or well-known. And I have, they do also have accommodations if you want to ask for them. And sometimes they're quite nice in the officer's clubs, and you can take your family or your friends who's ever traveling with you. But I haven't done anything much with the military now for a number of years. I came into WOSL in 1963 when I moved back to Lansing. And that was the first I'd heard about it, and one of the teachers that I was working with was WOSL, and she's the one that asked me. I actually feel like I sort of came in on a shoestring or by the back door, because I did not serve in a country that was at war at the time I was there. Of course, England was no longer at war, but we were serving Korea, and that's what the war was all about. And England itself apparently hardly knew the war was over. They still traveled with their dim lights on in the cars. They still were on rations on meat and butter and certain clothing items. They kept their shades pulled down at night.
What year was this?
And this was between 1952 and 1954. And in London and in the areas that had been badly bombed, very little effort had been made to replace these. They just put up big fences around and marked out bombed out area. And when I traveled in Germany, it was just the opposite. They were working frantically to rebuild and replace all of the bombed out areas. In England, they came to work about 9 o'clock in the morning and worked until 4 with 2 good tea breaks plus their lunch break. And in Germany, they worked from 7 o'clock in the morning until dark and right through the weekends. It was very interesting to see the difference in the attitude. Of course, England was getting no help from us because they were on our side. Germany, on the other hand, was the enemy, and as you know, our custom has been to help the enemy after we've defeated them. But I loved England, and I was given very good care. I was allowed to live off the base, finally, because they did not have good quarters. The women officers didn't have as good quarters as the teachers, as the civilian employees. They were given an allotment to live off the base, but we were not allowed to at first. And then they allowed me to for about 2 months, and then they took it away. But they did let me live on my own. And I lived in a lovely, lovely home.
Back in 53, 54, I hesitated to go to England because it was cold during the wintertime when I could have gone.
Well, you know, the kind of a winter we've had in Michigan this year has been a what we would call a mild winter. And they didn't have any even as cold weather as we had. A couple of times we had some cold weather. One time it went down to 19 degrees, and you'd have thought it felt like it was 9 below because it was damp.
I'm referring to the rooms you had. You warm at night.
In the house that I lived in, it was a 900-year-old house. It had belonged to the church in the little village of Coombe, and the church had long ago had to give it up. They could no longer support anything like that. So then some of the titled families had taken on these big homes, and when the war came on, they couldn't support them either. And the house that I lived in had been purchased by an older woman who only had had a third grade education, but who had gone to work at Blenheim Palace during World War I and had gotten lots of contacts while she was there. And when World War II came, she put in an application to build the roads at Vise Norton, and she got the contract. And she and her son built the roads at Vise Norton. And with the money that she had elevated herself out of a contact with the local people because she had money. But she could not associate with the upper class because she had no education. And so she had made up her mind that her life would be with the Americans. So she made this lovely big home. It had four very nice apartments in it, including hers. And the gatehouse was an apartment, and also the garden house. And the grounds were just gorgeous. Beautiful flowers and vegetables and all this sort of thing. And Mrs. Bishop took a liking to me. And so when I went to rent the apartment, she said, could I wait for 4 days while she had it cleaned? Well, when I got back there, she not only had it cleaned, she'd had all new carpets put in. She had taken the refrigerator, which had been in the hall and was supposed to have been shared by everybody, and that was now in my kitchen. And when I said something about it, she said, don't worry about that. She said, they can all get refrigerators of their own at PX. So I had the only refrigerator in the building beside the one that she had. And her husband furnished me with vegetables for 2 weeks. I had a cook. After I'd been there for 2 weeks, she suggested that I have a cleaning woman. And she said, don't have her come in the morning, just have her come in the afternoon and build your fire and cook your dinner. So I did. And I hadn't made any arrangements for any special food or anything. The first night I came home, I had lamb chops and potatoes and Brussels sprouts and the typical kind of thing that you have in England, the pudding. And this all came courtesy of Mrs. Bishop. And I said, well, you know, I want to pay you for this. No, no, she wouldn't let me. But I discovered that they couldn't get good beef or pork. So I used to buy beef and pork for her in the commissary, and then she bought lamb and veal for me, and which pleased me greatly. And so I had a very lovely experience with my cleaning woman cook combination, who unpacked my trunks when they came, pressed all my clothes, mended them. And when Halloween came, she insisted on making a costume for me, and baked and did all this kind of thing. And she did all the planning. I didn't do anything. I would say to her, you know, what do you want me to bring home? And she'd say, oh, we've got things. Well, and I found out, I watched how they bought their meat. The meat man came around with a little truck, and actually had a horse. And the neighbors would go out with their pans, and the meat was all hanging up inside. And they'd pick out what they wanted, and he'd cut it off and put it on their platter, and they'd bring it back in the house. And it wasn't the most hygienic kind of service in the world, but I never had any problem with it. And then I met people who worked at the post exchange, and they invited me to their home in Cheltenham, and I frequently went there for weekends. Now, that I was the coldest I ever was anywhere when I went to visit them, because they had an old apartment that had been at one time bombed out and repaired, and it had to be at least 9 feet, the ceilings had to be at least 9 feet tall, and the central heating, quote, was a small pipe about 2 inches in diameter that ran around the base of the floor. And then at one end of the room, they had a very small fireplace with a firebox that what I would say wasn't more than 8 or 10 inches deep, and probably dimensions of about 15 by 20 opening. And you know, that it's typical of the English women, the backs of their legs were all red. And this was from standing in front of heat, literally. But these people were simply great to me. And when I went there, I wore my uniform because it was the heaviest thing I had, and would take a sweater to wear in bed at night, and they would put a soapstone in my bed. And all these puffs and all this kind of thing, you know, you felt like you were going to be smothered. But then in the morning, they would bring you in your tea when you were so cold, you couldn't imagine putting your arms out to take the tea. And then and they used their rations. This is the thing that always worried me, and I always felt so guilty. Because then when I got ready to go home on Sunday, I would go on Saturday. And when I got ready to go home Sunday, I felt like a schoolgirl going back to home to school after spending the weekend at home, because they would pack boxes of food for me to take home, the leftover roast and puddings and cakes and gelatins and all sorts of things, you know, to take back to my room with me or to my apartment with me. But they were very friendly. I loved them. And I kept thinking I'd go back, but I haven't been able to. I really think that my association with WSL has been a really nice experience. At the time that I went into it, I really didn't know anything about the reason why I was in it, to tell you the honest truth. I didn't really know, I had not realized that the teachers, for instance, were sent over by the State Department and worked under the military. I mean, I knew that we had teachers at our base, but I didn't really know anything about their background. And in our unit in Lansing, the majority of our members are teachers, because I guess it was started by teachers. Is that true?
I don't know. Jane Tower was one of our first members.
And she was
Red Cross or nurse, I'm not certain.
I think she was Red Cross, yeah. But it's been a really fun experience, and it was one of the few social things that I did when I first went in and I was teaching in Lansing, and I was so tied up with my teaching and professional work that it was kind of a relaxing thing to go and be with the gals at WOSL. And now, since I've been retired and have been so busy with volunteering, I think I still, it's one of the few things that I do that isn't something that's going to require a lot of work. At least my unit work isn't. I ended up with a lot of national jobs, but it's been a really remarkable experience, and I've enjoyed it very much. I can't think of anything more that I should say. Can you? Anything more you want on the questions?
I guess not.
I think that this is a program that's important for us to do an oral history on our members, and Elsie is really having a lot of success getting the members to volunteer to be taped, and I'd like to see this go on.
Thank you, Jane Pyatt. The biographical data on Jane Pyatt is listed in a separate paper. Her address is Jane Pyatt, P-I-A-T-T, 13420 Bower Road, Eagle, Michigan, 48822. Her telephone is 517, this is the area code, and the number is 626-6601. Further contacts can be made directly with Jane.